In a year, I have been in correspondence with the one who is to bring us the message this morning, endeavoring to make arrangements for him to visit us at our Ohio camp meeting. Our speaker has been a leader in the denomination for many years. He is a Bible student, and he has written many books that are highly valued by our people. We're very happy that he can be with us here, not only for this morning, but for the entire period of our camp meeting. He will have all of the 11 o'clock services during the camp meeting. I'm very happy to introduce to you Elder Andreas.
The service this morning will be a little different from the ordinary service for the 11 o'clock hour. I have been asked to speak on the subject of the spirit of prophecy, more particularly my personal experiences with Sister White. There are not many remaining who have known and been with Mrs. White, and has thought best that this hour be used for that purpose. When I became an Adventist, I heard about Sister White, but I was given no special instruction. I simply accepted belief in the writings of the Spirit of Prophecy, as I did many other things, without going thoroughly into the subject. I gave up the eating of unclean things and the drinking of that which is not good, and I did let it go at that. I was brought up as a Protestant, and I stood at that time on the same platform Luther did when he placed his hand on the Bible and said, "Here I stand. Here on the Bible, here I stand, I can do no other, God helping me." And so I joined the Adventist Church, believing it to be a Protestant church. I was therefore surprised and perplexed when I came to a meeting to find the ministers using other books, quoting them, and saying, "As the Lord says." I was perplexed, because that was not Protestantism, according to my notion. But I let that go. I read the books and found them to be very good indeed, but that's all I thought of them. Then came the time when I prepared to teach. There I came face to face with the question that I knew I'd have to settle. Because if I were to teach children and young people, I must know for myself. Not merely by hearsay, not merely by reading, but by personal experience, if that were possible. I was attending at the time the Chicago University, not at that time nor now, noted for its orthodoxy or its religion, but I took there a course in the life of Christ. Desire of Ages had just come out, and I used that book as complementary reading. And I had opportunity there to go thoroughly into the reading, the teaching of that book. So day by day, I would read Desire of Ages as my additional reading and compare it with what I learned in class. And I found to my astonishment that many of the perplexing questions that even higher critics had to deal with were solved in Desire of Ages. I became more and more interested in it. At last it came to a kind of climax. What shall I do? What is my position? What ought it to be? And so, believing in direct action, I said, I'll go out and find Sister White and have a talk with her. So I did. I was but a young man, and when I knocked on the door, I hardly knew what to say. I did about what a student did much later in Union College when he came to my office and said, here I am. What are you going to do about it? Sister White received me very kindly. I suppose she sized me up and wondered what I was after. I said, I'd like to have the privilege of admission to the vault where all her writings were. I said, I have read all your books. I'm not interested in them as such, but I want to see how you wrote them before anybody got a hold of them and made corrections and omissions and past additions. She looked at me, said, you may have the privilege. And so I went to work. I stayed there 3 months and worked almost night and day. I read what was in the vault. A tremendous lot of work. I was perplexed when I saw the volume of it. If I had not seen it for myself, I'd have said, no one, however long he has lived, could ever write that much. But there it was. So I read Friends of the Great Controversy, written by her own hand. I thought that she dictated. She did dictate, but not much. Most of it was written by herself in her own handwriting. Then it was given to the stenographers. Then they copied it on 8.5 by 11 paper, double space, sometimes triple space. Then it was brought back to her for correction. Sometimes the stenographer would themselves make smaller corrections, but then they would sign their name to the correction and bring it to her for approval or rejection. I had brought with me from the university a great many quotations that I had found as I read the Desire of Ages very critically. I wanted to see how those statements were made originally before they were printed and before anybody got hold of them. For I repeat, I knew that Sister White had never written Desire of Ages. She couldn't. Of that I assure. I had an experience in class that gave me a new light on some things. The teacher, very proficient teacher, wrote on the blackboard a sentence. How sweet the moonlight sleeps upon this bank. I had no use for poetry. That was sissy stuff. Not for men. And when he put that on the board, I said to myself, whoever wrote that meant to say that the moon is shining. Why not say so? The teacher apparently could read my mind. For he said, now some of you will think that he ought to have said the moon is shining. He could have said that. That would be true, but it wouldn't be literature. Well, I didn't care for literature. He could have said the moon is shining sweetly, but that would be kind of silly. But when he says, how sweet the moonlight sleeps, and he had delightful sleeps, how sweet the moonlight sleeps upon this bank, suddenly something opened to my benighted mind, and I saw beauty where I had not seen it before. Then when he added, there are some things that can never be said unless it's said in poetry. I have found that to be true. That's why much of the Bible, not merely the Psalms, but much of the other part of the Bible is written in poetry. Because some things cannot be said at all and some not so well, unless it's said in poetry. So from that moment, I began to get interested in poetry. I had waded through Browning. And I said to myself, if I had Browning in the class, I'd send him home and learn how to write. Now, I was given the work of finding immortal lines in Desire of Ages, as I had done in Shakespeare. I don't believe I put that quite right, because that wasn't the word given me. That's the word I took as I looked up immortal lines in Shakespeare. And perhaps because of my inexperience and ignorance, I found more immortal lines in Desire of Ages than I did in Shakespeare. And I was astonished. And I knew Sister White had never written it. And with that in mind, I came out to see her. What did she write? What did she write before it was fixed up, as we say, by the those that read corrections, proofreaders? How it worked. I had brought with me also many statements regarding theology, because as I knew that Sister White could never have written Desire of Ages with that beautiful language, because she didn't have the education, she couldn't. So also I knew she never could have written that book with the theology in the book, unless she has had a very broad education, theological, and she hadn't. So I knew. I brought with me my statements, and as I compared them, reading now in the original, in her own handwriting, every one of those statements I found written by her own hand as they were printed. That was an astonishment to me. I well remember when we first discovered in Desire of Ages that tremendous statement, in Christ is life, original, unborrowed and underived. That changed my theology and the theology of the denomination. And as I read again and again, I found statements that I knew that she had not written, but there they were. When I was done with my work, after three months, and I had competent stenographic help, I was convinced that those writings could be explained on no other ground than that of divine guidance. I was not yet ready to accept all of them, but I've come that far, that those writings were written under the direction of God. Sister White herself was a very pleasant personality. I used to sit with her in the morning, early, 6, 5, and once 4, and she was up writing. She would sit in her rocking chair, arms and a board across those arms, and there she would write. I don't know why she accepted me, but I was apparently welcome. I sat there trying to find out all about her, and I suppose she was reading me while I was trying to read her. We had a good time together. Sister White, what do you mean by that statement? What statement? Then I read it. I don't understand it. Let's read it. Then she would open and read it. I don't know any more about that than you do. I was perplexed. Don't you know any more about it than I do know? I have to study it, same as you do. And sometimes she'll throw light on the statement, and sometimes she'll simply say, I don't know. That perplexed me greatly. Until I read what the Bible says about Prophet Peter says, that they themselves had to study their own writings to see what or what manner of time the Spirit of God which was in them did signify. And so she wrote. I repeat, every one of those statements I had with me, I found authenticated in her own handwriting. We discussed many things. I remember the first time I came in and saw her office. I found it to be very antiquated. No up-to-date office furniture. And I said to myself, if I ever get enough courage, I'll tell her what I think of her furniture. Well, the time came when, one morning, when she asked me, do you think I'm extravagant? I said, no, I don't. Well, there was a sister in here yesterday. And when she saw me sitting in this rocking chair, she accused me of extravagance. Now, I bought that second hand. I paid $8 for it. By the way, that chair, until late, was in cottage number one, I think, of the white cottages in Los Angeles. White Memorial. They have rebuilt now, so I don't know where it is. But I remember that chair very well. It was not extravagant. I had just read a history of the 16th and 17th century. And there I found rocking chairs mentioned. In my ignorance, I thought that rocking chairs had always existed and always been used. But it's not around, not till, until around the year 1800 or some years previously that became into common use. And being a new thing, it is not thought best for Christians to use them. In fact, it is a little bit doubtful that they ought to be used. I remember reading, and I just read it, a story about two young people that were so unhappy as to get a rocking chair for a wedding present. So I told Sister White this story. When it was among the Methodists, and it was around the year 17 or 90, just about. And when the Methodist elders found out that these young people had a rocking chair, they did about what Adventists would do, appoint a committee to see about it. And the committee went there and ascertained that they really did have a rocking chair. But the report read, which they brought back, that we labored with them, prayed with them, and when we left, the rockers were taken off, and the chair stood on four legs as a good Christian chair ought to stand. Then Sister White laughed. And again I was perplexed, because Sister White ought not to laugh. She ought always to be serious. But she laughed. She had a beautiful little laugh, not that of an old woman, but a tinkling girlish laugh, a delightful laugh. And I got used to it. So all right. She had delightful sense of humor. And I'm not speaking of foolish jokes, but delightful sense of humor. And oh, how much it'll save you. How much grief it'll save you. If you don't go around all the time with a chip on your shoulder, noticing that people are not giving you the attention that they should. Why, I'm it. They should pay more attention to me than they do. I well remember I stood on a certain corner in Minneapolis. I was then president of Union College, and I had to be very dignified, and doubtless was. There were two girls standing a little way off, discussing me and looking at me. I didn't see them. At least I thought. They thought I didn't see them. I didn't hear them. But one of them said to the other, one of them was a student of Union College, the other not. And the one asked, who is that man over there anyway? Why, that's the president of our college. That sort of thing. Now, I could have been, say, mortified, but no. I have learned a few things in life. One is not to take myself too seriously. And on the other hand, to be serious on things that are serious. Sister White has said it was very companionable. A mother in Israel. I learned many things. many things. She gave me full clearance. And when I left that time, I asked if I might have some of her writings. So I got, well, she answered, yes, you may have anything of which there are two copies. Being young and innocent, I took at her word and carried with me of that thin 8.5 by 11 paper, two packages, just about the height of this railing here. Three stenographers, 2 years to copy it, to recopy it. There was one place where Willie, the son, would not let me in. And as usual, when you may not do a certain thing, that's the thing you want to do. And so I went to Sister White. I knew what was in there. It was the document, the family documents, that nobody ought to read but the family. I had no business to do it. If I'd had a little more sense, I wouldn't have asked to do it. I went there. Sister White says, you may read it. So I went to Willie. And he gave a famous reply. I don't doubt your word, but I don't believe it. So we went, both of us, to Sister White. And I said, Willie won't let me in. And we discussed it, and she gave permission. And so I read. Perhaps I shouldn't have, but I'm glad I did. There I saw in her own handwriting the letters from the time she was 14 years old to her relatives, her friends. Letters were long in those days, 10, 12, 15, 18 pages. I suppose they didn't write every day. And she would give just a few words of a personal nature. She might say, yesterday, I went down to see the dentist. I didn't know they had dentists in those days. Or she might say, I went down and bought 8 yards of calico and I'm going to make myself a dress. All the rest of those letters you could put on the front page of the review today. You wouldn't need to add any name to it, but every old Adventist at least would say, that's Sister White. It's a sermon. Those were the kind of letters. And many things there that should not be revealed, but all of the same kind. And I was again profoundly impressed by the fact, a young girl not writing for publication, not writing that a young man 50 or more years later would read it, but just the ordinary letter, the same spirit as in all her writings. My speech today is merely a testimony. It is not a sermon. I am not proving anything. I'm just witnessing, giving my testimony. When I left, Sister White gave me a complete set of all her books and put her name in them. I valued that highly, and not knowing any better, I lent them out. And I got them back without the page where the name was written. All except Desire of Ages. And I don't think I'll let you have that. I treasure that highly. I went away perplexed and satisfied because I had seen that which could not be written by her, and yet it was. I had found no end of statements concerning theology that are most profound, written by a woman of a limited education. But I was convinced, as I said, that though I did not understand all, here God had been at work. Many years later, I was asked to teach in the theological seminary. I said I'd be glad to, if I may have the privilege once more of going through the vault. I got that privilege. 3 summers I worked with competent help. Again, I read all, and rather critically. I could read reasonably rapid, which, by the way, all of you and all ministers particularly might do well to learn. to read rapidly without losing the contents and being able to remember. That can be done. And we found that you could take the graduating class in a college and teach them reading. And they'd improve not merely 10 and 20 and 30, but as much as 50% in grasp of subject and in rapidity of reading. So I read, and I think critically, as far as I could. And when I was done, I was again profoundly impressed. And now finally, that here was that which man had not written. Here was God-indicted writings. Do I then worship Sister White? Oh, no. Do I put it on a pedestal? No. But only at the peril of my soul may I reject those writings or neglect them that God has given us to guide. Not new light there is for many of us because we haven't read as we should before. Rather, as she herself said, that her writings are a magnifying glass. It doesn't reveal that which is not there, but it makes clear that which is there. And so, since then, I have used it. Used them, well, before also, all my life. I have in my position more than 20,000 statements on theology, not in our books, but in our periodicals. And I wouldn't let them go for a good deal. And I have found in my own study help again and again. Oftentimes, I'll struggle with a problem. At last, I'll get it. And then I'll take, by chance sometimes, a piece of Sister White, and there it is. That which I struggled weeks and months to get, there it is. The testimonies are not written to draw us away from the Bible, but rather to the Bible. Again, it has a strange influence on me and on you. You read it, and you go away saying, Lord, I'll have to be a better man. I'll never see the kingdom unless I repent this, that, and the other thing. That's the aim, that's the purpose, that's the result of reading the testimony. They draw me to the Bible. They magnify God, magnify the Bible. Are there not in the testimony many things that a heart understands? To that I'd answer yes. As I said, when I came to the seminary, I will not be deceived. And I will not deceive. I'll go as far as my mind can go. And I'll know the truth. Yes, there are things hard to understand. There's something in the Bible I've struggled with for a good many years. And I wish they weren't there. But they're there. Throw them out? No. No. Wait. Wait. You'll find statements that you may not understand. It's in school. One student came to me. I have found a contradiction. Sister White says both that God is judge and that God is not judge. God is not judge. Christ is judge. And here God is judge. You'll find part of that in the chapter of Great Controversy. There you'll find the Father sitting in judgment and presiding in the judgment. He is the judge and Christ is the advocate. You'll find later on in the same book that God is not judge. What do you do about that? Just leave it until you get light. What light may you get? You can find, or you'll find generally, that you may believe that and you'll believe the other also. Even though it seems to be contradictory, but light will come. Now the Father is judge in the investigative judgment. Christ is judge in the day of judgment, in 1,000 years. They're both true, both statements. The Father is judge, the Father is not judge. Christ is judge, Christ is not judge. They refer to two different things. In the investigative judgment, the Father is judge. It says so definitely. In the judgment of the world, 1,000 years, Christ is judge. God has given all things into his hand. He's a merciful and just high priest. No, you will not find anything there that you may not believe, even though you may find many things you may not understand. Some time ago, I read this statement from Sister White. The books of heaven record the sins that would have been committed had there been opportunity. That's a dreadful thing. Let me read it again. The books of heaven record the sins that would have been committed had there been opportunity. They've recorded not merely what you have done, but what you would have done if you had had the chance. Is that fair? It's a dreadful statement to me. Then I'm not as good as I thought I was. What would I have done if I'd been in the other man's place? Oh, I condemn him. What would I have done? And that brings some serious thoughts. I go out. I'm going to kill a man. I'm going to shoot him. I point my gun at him, pull the trigger, but being a poor shot, I don't hit him. Have I done anything? I intended to kill him. And that's written down in the books of heaven. I poisoned one. But I take the wrong bottle and nothing happens. Am I guilty? Yes. The books of heaven record the sins that would have been committed had there been opportunity. And I have seen men sit in judgment on men, on a man, when the judges were worse than the criminal. It may be well to consider ourselves in the light of God once, but I said to myself, that's a dreadful statement. Isn't there some balancing statement somewhere? That balancing statement you'll have need of sometime, because you'll find again and again extreme statements. Now, is there any balancing statement? Let me read. This is 1 Samuel I read now. As his part is that goeth down to the battle, so shall his part be that tarried by the stuff. They shall part alike. The man that goes down to the battle and the man that stays home to care of the stuff, they shall share alike. Is that fair? Brother Saul goes down to South America, get 1,000 souls, 1,000 stars. His brother stays at home on the farm. He'd gladly go, but somebody must stay, so he stays. Now the good book says they shall share alike. That's a wonderful statement, isn't it? Same as we are responsible for what we would have done had the opportunity, so we'll get credit for what we would have done of good if we had had the opportunity. That should be a privilege to some of comfort to some of you wives whose husbands go out preaching and you stay home to care the babies. I never brought a soul to Christ. You have stayed at home. And he that stays at home shall share alike with him that goes to battle. That's a wonderful statement we get here. Some time ago, I met a young minister. I just finished an effort. 20 stars in my crown. I gained 20 souls. And he was happy. Happy. Then I asked him, did you have any helpers with you? Oh, yes. I had really a wonderful Bible work, as we call them in those days. Did she do any good? Oh, yes. She visited. Did much good. She brought two to the meeting that I had never seen. I said, would you give her any share in that? Those 20? Why, yes, I suppose she should have a share in them. Should anyone else have a share? I don't know. Did you have any music? Yes. Did not people come, and did you not intend that they should come because of the music? Should they have no share? Yes, I'm afraid they should. Did anybody help you invite people by a handbill or any other means? Yes. Would you give them a little of your 20? Yes. But if you keep on, I won't get anything. Well, that's not the point. Are there others that you'd have? Who paid you your wages? and help the tent. Well, the conference did.
Oh.
Where did they get the money?
From the people.
Would you give the people a little credit? Would you give the officers of the conference that help you encourage you a little credit?
Yes, but I'm losing out completely.
Anyone else? Yes, there are many that have read themselves into the truth 20 years before, but never accepted it. Now, I came along, and I reaped from them. Would the Coldwater have a little credit?
Yes, I suppose so.
Would you go so far as to take in those workers in the publishing house? Yes, but would you think that they should have a little credit that came to your meetings, our own people, when you began and you wanted an audience and want to show that you had an audience and all that did was to just to come and sit and that encouraged others to come in also? Would you give them a little credit? I have two left now. Well, if you have two left, by all means, give the one to your wife. No, sometimes we take credit, and I'm always interested in when the ministers report what they have done. I suppose they get credit, but often they do not state it. No, you'll find that the Bible and the Spirit of Prophecy, very consistent and very able. Are there not some statements about health reform that we can accept? I bear positive statements against, or positive testimony against, then come the list. Well, let's reject that. Perhaps you better not. Let me tell you a little experience of my own. Now, I am in the habit of stopping exactly on the, at the time, but I'm afraid I cannot do that today. So you'll bear with me if I run a little over time. I used a canvas. That's good for the soul. Start out Monday morning and have it all slammed in your face. That puts you in your place. I said, good for the soul. Everybody ought to try it. And those of you who think you're somebody too good, you especially need it. Well, I canvas. And I believed in health reform and practiced it. I was going to say I passed more than I should. I well remember how we gave up everything. And that's just about true. Everything. Of course, unclean foods of any kind, meats of any kind, not to mention. But we gave up sugar and salt and yeast and milk and eggs and butter. And if you can mention anything else, we gave it up. We barely thought we were serving God. Now, we took a wrong position. The testimonies are always fair and moderate. You can read Counsels on Health today, and you'll find there that the heading, Counsels on Health, that's about the heading it ought to be. It's counsel. Well, we were taught by some that doubtless knew or did the best they knew. But when word came to us at last that we might not eat anything that grew underground except peanuts, then we had very little left, because if you took away potatoes and everything that grows underground and bread, you could hardly, you had a hard time making that without yeast. And yeast, that was wicked. So we didn't do that. I had left in my menu, however, that good food we used in those days, granola. Now, some of you are too young to know anything about granola. It looks like crushed zwieback. You crush it and crumble it. Only it is much better. It consists of five kinds of grain. Very nourishing and very good. On that I lived. That and water and nothing else. And two meals a day. On that I canvassed. I should have died, but I didn't. I grew fat on it. It is good food. And let no man ever despise that. I love it to this day. I wish I'd get more of it. But now, I thought that that was necessary. I would never sit down to a meal anywhere. I ate my granola and water. That worked very fine.
It got a little tiresome. And I wondered after a few weeks if it would be very wicked if I should add a few raisins to my granola. I did. But only for a few days, then my conscience smote me, and I gave up my raisins and my granola and water. Granola had the bad habit of swelling when it got wet, which was not always so good. But I did get tired, may I say, of that everlasting granola. And yet I hope I'm not saying anything to discourage anything, because that's good stuff. Excellent. I'm sitting outside Joliet prison, tired, hot, a summer noonday. On the other side of the road was a man selling pineapples. Oh, if I could only buy a pineapple. But that is probably wicked. But I compromised with the conscience and bought a pineapple and ate it. Ate it all. With the result that the skin, the acid, just wore off the skin around my mouth. And now I knew that that was punishment for my eating pineapple. So I gave up my pineapple. Then came the climax, that which brought me to my senses. You understand, all this was not Sister White's teaching. God forbid, she's sensible. She's reasonable. She'll counsel. Then I read that we eat too much. Now, that statement was true then, and it's true now. But, dear brethren, it is not true of me. But I read it, and I said, if that's so, I had granola twice a day and water, then I better cut my granola in two. And I did. And so I ate my little granola and water. But then when I turned to the book still said that I ate too much. Well, what could I do? Well, I could cut it in two once more, but I didn't. I did some thinking. I sat down, and I said to myself, now I can cut that in two, and in two, and two, and however far I go, it'll still say, you eat too much. So I learned there a lesson that stood me in good stead all these years, to use what little sense I have in reading. We are not in need of being any more slack than we are. We are too slack. And we don't need encouragement along that line. We need to read what has been written about good eating, about good living, and live up to it. And we ought to, as Seventh-day Adventists. But I bring that to your attention for the reason that we'll have to use what sense we have and apply it where it applies and not otherwise. My father was a good man, and he used to tell me how where he was brought up, they made cheese. I tasted that, I knew it. And it did taste good. But I also knew how it was made. In those days, we milked. Never thought of washing our hands or the cow, but just milked. And the milk came down here, and there's a beautiful white streak down to the pail. When that milk was poured out into, when we got it in bottles and poured out the bottle, how careful we were to pour out all we could get, not get that last eighth of an inch or quarter of an inch of real filth. Am I speaking something that's unknown to you? Have you ever heard of that, any of you? Have you ever experienced or known how milking was done? I have. Of that I could say much. That kind of milk is not fit for human consumption. I was over in Java, and I saw the same thing. And I said to myself, I bear positive testimony against milk. That kind. Then later, when everything was inspected and pasteurization came in, then Sister White herself spoke of milk and used it. Those things are not contradictory. They're true, and those statements are true today as they ever were, but under like conditions. So, do not use this as an excuse for eating and drinking what you please. What has been written, you better read that carefully. Because every statement holds true today. There may be a balancing statement somewhere. Get that then. But do not neglect or reject that which has been written for our learning. As we near the harbor, we need a pilot. Thus she speaks of her work. I feel like giving a solemn warning to our people on the neglect of those writings that God has given us. How shall we escape? That's speaking of the Bible now. How shall we escape if we neglect, not reject? None of us reject, but we neglect. And how shall we escape? I'd like to apply that also to these writings. How shall we escape? We'll have to give an account. So I believe that it's into a solution. And by, you may get light. I have a compartment in my brain. I had a good many years where I put questions I don't understand. I used to worry about them. And as a teacher particularly, well, a teacher ought to know all things. And it never do for a teacher to say, I don't know. Then I learned what a blessing it was to be able to say, I don't know. I put those up there and gathered questions for eternity. Once in a while, some of those questions would come out and be solved. But for everyone I solved, I got 10 more to put in here. I advise you to get a brain, to get a compartment in your brain where you can put questions that you may not fully understand. Don't disbelieve them necessarily, but weigh them. And it may be that after a year or two, that solution will come, and you will thank God for it. How shall we escape if we neglect? I thank God for the privilege of being a Seventh-day Adventist. It's a wonderful thing. But friend, if we neglect the very means God has given us, how shall we escape? And so today, shall we not renew our faith and allegiance to the flag, yes, but more to that banner, the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And that takes in the whole faith. That takes in the writings that have been given us for this time. So again, I magnify God's name. Wonderful, wonderful. God is bringing out a people that know the future as no people has ever known it. We know what's coming. We know the persecutions. We know the trials that will come. When the last day, perilous times shall come. Shall we fear them? Gird on the armor. Stand like a rock. And God will yet see his people through.